From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, ballet, politics, religion, and Professor Watermelon. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Today, authors, teachers, musicians, and thinkers. But first, contributor Shannon Forsell talks with Indianapolis Ballet's artistic director Victoria Liris about their upcoming performances of The Nutcracker, as well as the long-awaited debut of a resident ballet company in Indianapolis.
So it's not Christmas without the Nutcracker. Everyone has to see the Nutcracker, and we're here to serve. Indianapolis Ballet is got their performance of the Nutcracker coming up, and I'm here with Victoria. Victoria, we're so excited about this. Tell us about the Nutcracker.
This is indeed a very exciting year for us. This is our 11th annual production of The Nutcracker, and once again this year it will be at the Murat with live orchestra, not the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra this time around, because they were already double booked and there was absolutely no way that they could spread so thin for another production. So we have gathered an incredible orchestra that's being produced by Blake Schlabach, who is with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra, and Vince is our conductor again. So we have a fabulous 45-piece orchestra accompanying the Nutcracker again this year, and which really the Murat in itself calls for live music. And what's exciting and special about our Nutcracker that it is truly indigenous to Indianapolis. When I started the production 11 years ago, I was looking for a specific Victorian look for it, for the party scene, and that's when I first walked into the Morris Butler House and looked at the parlor, and I said, this is it, the Etruscan red walls, everything was perfect. So really, when the curtain goes up after the overture, you are facing the Morris Butler home at on Park Avenue. It is Park Avenue. And then when that scrim goes up, then we are literally inside the parlor. And that's where the first 25 minutes of the ballet begins. And then, of course, we go into the land, into the battle scene and the snow scene, and then, of course, to the land of sweets. Beautiful sets and costumes. The scenic design was all by David Higgins of Indiana University. The costumes have been made by my mother and myself.
Let's talk a little bit about that, because that's amazing to me. We were talking about this a little bit before we went on the air, and that is what it is to be a nonprofit. You know, by day you're raising money, and at 3 a.m. you are, you know, sewing costumes.
When you have deadlines, you stay up and you get the job done like any other profession. You know, if you're a doctor and you're on call, you're up all night. If you're a director and you have, you know, you need to make a Firebird tutu, you're up until you get the job done. So we have deadlines, and I just, you know, if I'm in the mood to be sewing after a long day of rehearsals and the business side of the organization, of course, then I get to work. And I enjoy the creative process. I love textiles. I love textures. I think I was supposed to be, if not a dancer, I was supposed to be probably an interior designer or something else in my life. But I do love the whole aesthetic of a production. And other than the actual lighting, which I do suggest what the vision that I have for a production, but then I hand it over to James Leitner, who's our lighting designer, production manager. But it's a complete package, the choreography, the music, the dancers, preparing the dancers, rehearsing them, putting all the costumes in place. And it's magical. It's truly magical. And these performances are at the Murat, December 21st, 7:30, the 22nd at 2 and 7:30, and the 23rd also at 3 p.m. that day on a Saturday.
That's fantastic. Are you going to be able to get the costumes done by the
21st? Oh, yeah. So, no, Nutcracker. Right. Nutcracker is a done deal. Actually, I'm still working on a new Snow Queen costume. So,
that's great.
Yeah, so every so often we need an update because the original one is looking tired. So we retired that one.
That's fantastic. So if you want to see the beauty of the Nutcracker, both the beauty of the dancers, the beauty of the set, and the beauty of these costumes, please head out to the Murat December 21st through the 23rd to just really see really what is synonymous with the holidays, and that's mm-hmm. the Nutcracker. And that's just one of the things we have to talk about, because there are numerous things happening with Indianapolis Ballet and the Indianapolis School of Ballet, and some very exciting things for our city, and that yeah. is that you're going to have a full-time ballet company, and it's been 12 years since our city has had a ballet company. And so tell me about that. Why now? What is your excitement about the ballet? And
I think it has taken this time, I think, for the city to recover. Mm-hmm. Maybe, and to trust again. And mind you, you know, we went through a recession,
sure,
which was
sure
very
did.
Tough. And the Indianapolis School of Ballet has survived through that. And now we're very healthy in our 12th year. And the time is now. It feels right. Balanchine always said, what are you waiting for? You know, the time is now. And I feel it. I usually go with what I feel. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people will say to me, well, I'm not in your gut. I said, that's okay. But I know when it's right. And now is the time. We have really, I think, embedded ourselves in the thread of the community. We are downtown. We haven't moved. We haven't changed. The mission and the vision of this organization from day one was to start with a school, but first a school, words mm-hmm. of Balanchine. And now the time has come for the company. We have the dancers. I have groomed many dancers that went away to dance with Nashville Ballet and Cincinnati Ballet and other companies. And now they're coming home. They're ready to come home and dance here. So it's pretty exciting. We have already contracted a dozen dancers.
Wow, yeah, that's fantastic.
Yeah. So it's pretty exciting. And this the company will launch January of 8th of 2018 with rehearsals. And our first production will be in February 16th through the 18th at the Toby. And what's really wonderful, we are the resident ballet company at the Toby at Newfields.
Mm-hmm.
So this partnership has been truly remarkable, and the timing could not have been better, really, because everything is new. It's new for them. It's new for us.
Right.
So, and it's really, I'm so grateful and truly, truly relieved that we have the Toby to call home.
That's fantastic. So, it's also fantastic for, and I'm going to say the Indianapolis Museum of Art, for those that haven't, you know, made that connection yet with that Indianapolis Museum of Art being a part of the Newfields campus,
right,
and that new exciting campaign of theirs. You know, one of the things that I hear a lot about producing ballet performances are the extreme cost to create a show with that kind of set, that kind of costuming,
mm-hmm.
and that is actually one of the challenges when you have a company such as that are the performances and the cost of those themselves. How, in this world we're in today, how do you navigate that?
Well, it's a combination of many expenses. I think, you know, for a ballet company, the major expenses fall into play. A, you have to pay your dancers. They are highly skilled professionals.
Thank you. Yes.
I do not believe in not paying dancers. I've worked with both union and non-union companies, and that was always a priority to me, not only to pay the dancers a reasonable cost of living wage, but also to provide health benefits for them. So those
wow.
two factors are very much in place.
That's fantastic.
And I was not going to start a company or call any part of this organization, a full-fledged professional company, until those two factors were in place. Then the other thing is that, yes, the production costs are very expensive. Pointe shoes for the ladies are very expensive. A pair of pointe shoes can be anywhere from $75 to $120, depending on the brand and so on. And then, of course, there's the scenery and the sets and the and the costuming. And it helps when you have friends who believe in your vision and who are willing to help you along the way. So yes, those are costs. But what really I am extremely grateful for is the major grant we just received from the Alan Whitehill Clues Charitable Foundation. I am in... so grateful to Mr. Marshall for being our champion and for the Clues Foundation for being our champion these past 12 years and for them to believe in this dream and to stand by us because this is truly validation that we are here. We are here to stay, not only with these initial 15 weeks and hopefully 17 weeks of employment for the dancers this year, but it has secured next year, fiscal year 19, with 30 weeks of work for the dancers.
Well, congratulations.
So it's
this
exciting.
Is going to be such an exciting journey. You can start that journey by going and seeing the Nutcracker in December 21st through the 23rd. And we're really excited for the success of the Indianapolis Ballet and seeing all the exciting things that are to come. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
Indianapolis Ballet's Victoria Liris chatted with contributor Shannon Forsell. Indianapolis Ballet and Indianapolis School of Ballet present the Nutcracker December 21st through December 23rd. Order tickets online at oldnationalcenter.com, and center is C-E-N-T-R-E, oldnationalcenter.com. And for more information about Indianapolis Ballet, visit indianapolisballet.org. Reading is a great escape for many people, including Chadwick Gillenwater, an Indianapolis-based author. He's written several nonfiction books under his given name, but he took a pen name to write some children's books. And the pen name came from a simple interaction with a kid over a decade ago. Contributor Emily Matheny got the story.
More than 10 years ago, Chadwick Gillenwater was a librarian in Seattle, Washington, when he heard a child missay his name. The kid ran into the library and shouted for Mr. Watermelon. It turned out that Chadwick's name on the playground wasn't Gillenwater, it was Mr. Watermelon.
When I started writing children's books, I decided I like that watermelon idea. But instead of Mr. Watermelon, I'm going to be Professor Watermelon. And then I started wearing the funky bow ties and the cool shoes. And then I wanted to start a creative writing program for kids. And I knew that if I wanted to show them that writing could be fun and you could be silly, that being Professor Watermelon automatically kind of brings that to the forefront. It shows kids that I'm willing to be fun and silly, and that's exactly what I want them to feel in my classes. Writing can be serious, but to let your guards down when you're writing, to let the inspiration flow, and Professor Watermelon, I have found, does that really well.
The professor has taught writing clubs and camps for different schools, including private schools and summer camps in Indianapolis. But the idea behind having Watermelon University was to have classes open to anyone. Classes take place twice a month at various locations around the city. Some past locations include the Ida Jorg Museum, the Indiana State Museum, the Indiana Humane Society, and the Madam C.J. Walker Theater. The idea is to bring the children to a location to inspire and act as a springboard for stories. For one of his recent classes at Holiday Park, the professor focused on owls because the park has a resident owl named Owl Livia. For Chadwick, he doesn't need to go to a location to be inspired. He's inspired every day.
Writing to me is my life. Like, there is not a day that goes by that I don't think of a story. I'm more of a storyteller, I would say, than a writer. Writing is my medium to get my art across. And that's exactly the way I promote writing with my students. Writing has a lot of rules, and those rules are great to learn. But I like to inspire children to want to write, to understand that everyone has a story. Everyone can create a story, and most human beings love telling stories. But the only way we can get them recorded without using maybe audio is to actually write them down. And when you empower kids to write their stories down and then share it with others, they really, they're proud. So writing to me is my way of sharing my light. It's my way of communicating with the world. If you want to really know who I am, read one of my books, because you will find that's the window to my imagination. And I think most human beings, well, all human beings are like that. We have a window to our imagination, and we all have different ways of sharing that. Mine is writing. It might be sculpting for another person, or it might be science for somebody else. It's all our way of expression.
Chadwick's most recent book, George and the Goblin Hole, pulls from one of Indiana's famous writers, James Whitcomb Riley. The story's main character is the fifth great-grandson of the butler who worked in the home. The story is fictitious, but the inspiration came from the real place. It is the application of what the professor teaches his students in his courses and clubs.
The best part about writing a book for children is that I get to sit in my own childhood wonder. And I think that's magical. I think that whenever an adult can do that, it's healing, because you get to sit in your own childhood. You get to communicate with your own inner child. And when you're able to do that, you realize the world isn't so dark and scary. And so writing books for kids is actually just as much for me as it is for my audience. When I'm writing a book for children, I'm actually writing that book for me, for the child in me.
Watermelon University is continuing to grow. The students work on their writing skills as they tell their stories. For Chadwick, this program gives kids another chance to be creative.
There's a lot of kids that are interested in sports and physical activities, which I think is great. But sometimes there aren't enough activities for kids that like to spend their time and their imagination and create. So at Watermelon University, we like to say that writing is our sport. So if your kid is interested in creativity of any kind, Watermelon University would be the perfect place for them.
Professor Watermelon with contributor Emily Matheny. Learn more about classes and books at professorwatermelon.com. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Coming up, the Indie native who identified Watergate's deep throat. But right now, Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with urban farmer Chad Brandenburg of Roca Farms. He's converted a former East Side grocery store into an indoor hydroponic farm.
We are a hydroponic farm that utilizes hydroponic technology to grow food more efficiently and more nutritionally sustainably than can be done typically on a soil farm at this point. We use heirloom seeds and the powder nutrient to grow all of the herbs and microgreens and things that we're growing right now.
Now, how do you grow it? So it's inside. We're in a former grocery store building. Mm-hmm. How do they actually grow? Kind of describe the structures they're growing on.
Sure. This is actually true vertical farming. These are vertical structures. They're called grow towers. They're 7 feet tall. The water comes through and drips from the top, runs down the medium, touching all the plants on the way down, and then gets recycled back into the nutrient tank. So we have no chemical runoff. We use about 5% of the water that a standard soil farm would use, and just keep everything really contained and give the plants exactly what they're looking for.
So the fertilizing, the nutrients, that sort of thing, that's all in the water that's dripped through?
That's correct. Yeah, the nutrient level is called the EC, or electroconductivity, and that is the really fancy way of describing the nutrient component that is fed to the plants.
Now, what about the lights? You must control all of that as well.
Yeah, so we have the lights were designed with a specific spectrum in mind that the plants really like to mimic the outdoors, and we turn them on and turn them off based on, you know, the grow times and things that we want the plants to have.
So what kind of plants are you growing here, and what kind can you grow?
Right now, we're focusing on herbs in the main grow area, and then we're also doing microgreens. But we can grow anything green and leafy, you know, field crops, corn, soybeans, things like that, that we probably could, but not effectively, right? You could with a different system than we've chosen with the lights, but, you know, those are best left for soil farms. But anything, you know, herbs, lettuces, we can grow peppers and those kinds of things here as well. But our focus right now is herbs and microgreens.
Well, now tell me how they grow, because obviously they're towers, so they're kind of coming out and up, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We plant into the medium. The grow tower is put on a stainless steel table. We have the seedlings. The seedlings get put into the medium and then slid into the grow tower, and then it's put back into the vertical system. So the water drips in the top and runs all the way down. So we grow the seedlings, germinate first, then grow the seedlings in a seedling rack, and then the seedlings go into the grow towers.
So I'm imagining people might have in their head, you know, we see the advertisements for, in magazines, tomatoes that grow in a bag. You hang them and they grow up. You hang them on your wall out in your yard or something. So right. It's something people can imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the technical term is tropism. So the plants are going to grow up towards the sun, in our case up towards the lights, although the lights are parallel basically to the grow towers. But, you know, the plants do come out and then kind of go up.
So question, could you grow tomatoes this way?
In our system that we have here, no, but in a different system called a Dutch bucket system, you absolutely can grow tomatoes.
Okay, so this is just fascinating. I find that the idea of a farm is, well, the concept is changing, isn't it?
It is. You know, there's only so much arable land left. You have communities that are sprawling, urban sprawl. You have between farms and housing developments, a lot of the land is getting eaten up. So, you know, in a 10,000 square foot space here, I can grow roughly what a 250 acre farm could grow with 5% of the water that's used on the farm. So, I mean, all of those things, you know, when you look at it from a resource standpoint, I can do a lot pretty efficiently, effectively, and sustainably inside of a former grocery store.
You can hear Jolene Katzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm your host, Sharon Gamble. Still to come, a small studio session by a band that pioneered the Fountain Square music scene. But now we turn our attention to an Indianapolis native who wrote the first article identifying a former FBI agent as the anonymous source Deep Throat during the Watergate investigation. The author has now had the book he wrote about that man turned into a movie. It's called Mark Felt, The Man Who Brought Down the White House. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer learned more.
I talked to John O'Connor. He actually grew up here in Indianapolis. He went to St. Joan of Arc and Cathedral and Notre Dame, and then he continued his career as an attorney in California. And that's where he first learned about Mark Felt through Felt's grandson. Now, the grandson actually attended Stanford University and was friends with O'Connor's daughter. And one night, the grandson was having dinner at the O'Connor house.
In which I told funny stories about my father, who was an FBI agent for a while, later was a lawyer in Indianapolis. And as I was telling the story, this fellow, Nick Jones, said, well, you know, my grandfather was in the FBI, too. Maybe your dad knew my granddad. And I said, oh, great, Nick, what's his name? And he said, his name's Mark Felt. And, of course, my jaw dropped because I had sort of pinned him as Deep Throat probably 30 years earlier, 25 years earlier, in 1976 or so. I'd come to that conclusion. So I immediately told Nick that his grandfather was Deep Throat. Could I come up and talk to him? I think I know why he's not come out, and I think I can talk to him. This was somewhat overwhelming for the young man, but he was intrigued and told his mother. And later that week, he called up and said, gee, Mom's really excited. Could you come up this Sunday? And as they say, the rest is history. That was in April of 2002.
O'Connor met with Felt, who admitted that he was deep throat and that he and his family were ready to tell his story. But Felt wanted journalist Bob Woodward to write it. Woodward and fellow Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein exposed the Watergate conspiracy and wrote the book All the President's Men.
So I spent several months trying to talk Bob Woodward into cooperating with us in the story, and of course Bob would never admit nor deny that he was deep throat, but continued to talk to the family without ever agreeing to cooperate. So finally, after it became apparent that Woodward would not cooperate with us in our venture, we then sought a publisher.
In 2005, O'Connor published an article in Vanity Fair magazine revealing that Mark Felt was deep throat. The family wanted to tell more of Felt's story in a movie, but O'Connor said they needed to write a book first.
We knew that Mark was not able to recall anything from the past. We knew he had some past writings. So I decided I would write a book using partially Mark's old writings and partially the research that I had done, the interviews I'd done with his friends, his family, his colleagues in the FBI, my research about Watergate that I'd been doing over the years, the FBI files that I had retrieved that showed his memos during Watergate.
In 2006, O'Connor published the autobiography on Felt called A G-Man's Life, The FBI Being Deep Throat and the Struggle for Honor in Washington. Soon after, Hollywood came calling.
So we had plenty of interest in the movie, and we went with Universal Pictures with the proviso in there that it was exclusively to be directed by Tom Hanks. In other words, Tom Hanks would have control over the property. We were very excited about that. He could command a big budget. And we came close to doing the movie in 2008. We had a time slot for it that Tom had set aside. We had a cast that was looked pretty promising. Annette Bening was going to be the wife. Tom Hanks was going to be Deep Throat. And Paul Giamatti was going to be the local FBI agent named Angelo Lano. We had a pretty promising cast. Then the writer's strike occurred. We lost our spot to Angels and Demons. After that, Tom Hanks lost interest. And so if he lost interest, well, no one else under the terms of our deal could do the film. So that sort of put it in a graveyard for a while. In the course of that, we had developed a wonderful writer, Peter Landesman, and he and I had been doing scripts and had some very good ones. And then Peter ended up being the writer and director for the film. Universal also assigned a wonderful director by the name of Jay Roach. Jay is still, as is Tom Hanks, they're still attached to the movie we made, but what they did was, at a certain point, they let Peter and Ridley Scott run with the ball and do the movie.
Are you still in contact with his family? And if so, what is their reaction to the film?
We're very close, and the family is thrilled. They're thrilled with the depiction of Mark. They think it's really tells the story of a real-life hero. And it really kind of is I think Peter Landesman says it best. This is the story of a guy who donated a hospital wing but didn't want his name on it. If it hadn't have been for Woodward's book, Mark would have died, gone to the grave with his secret. He was not in this for glory. He was taking chances with his own career, put everything at risk, including his fragile wife, who ended up killing herself, I might say, to some degree caused by the events that are depicted in the movie, including his arrest. Not his arrest, but his conviction for breaking in on the Weather Underground. But Mark risked everything to do what he thought was right. It's not going to be in 3,000 theaters. It's going to be at sort of selected highbrow theaters, I would say, art houses, the better theaters around. But it's not going to be a big a big film in that sense, but I think it's going to be one that endures. It really is really tells the tale like no mm-hmm. other. Nothing is ever done.
Right, yeah. Because a lot of times people will say, I read the book and the movie is nothing like the book. You wrote the book and you're saying the movie is just as good and true to the book.
But yes, and what we run into, though, is people, many people haven't read my book, but they've read Woodward and Bernstein's book. Well, and so some people will say, well, the movie isn't like that book. And, of course, that's exactly our point. Our movie is not intended to be like All the President's Men. It's intended to be the flip side or the bookend to All the President's Men, telling the story from a completely different vantage point. Both of them true, but from completely different points of view.
The movie is in limited release right now. It's also being entered in several film festivals around the country, and it stars Liam Neeson and Diane Lane. And John is actually very pleased with the way that the movie turned out, and his book is kind of getting recirculated again, too. So it's an interesting story and something different to see this time of year.
Well, I don't have anything that politically compelling in my calendar list today, but it is time for our calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
I have gingerbread villages, though. The gingerbread village at Connor Prairie is on view. In fact, it stays on view through January 7th. You can see a variety of gingerbread masterpieces created by both amateurs and professionals. Viewing the village is free for members with paid general admission to Connor Prairie.
At the Indie Fringe Theater, it's Christmas Through the Ages on December 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. It's a hysterically historical holiday musical. Julie Lynn Barber, local artist, is a performer, is there. It's humorous, it's endearing, it's musical. It's kind of a lighthearted show if you're tired of the Nutcracker. Tickets available at indiefringe.org.
On a completely different note, having nothing to do with Nutcrackers or the holidays, actually, the Indiana Arts Commission announced a couple days ago the selection of Adrian Matika, Bloomington, Indiana resident, as the new Indiana State Poet Laureate. You might remember our contributor Mark Allen did a nice interview with him a few months ago. Matika was actually born in Nuremberg, Germany, but he grew up in California and in Indiana. His most recent book, Map to the Stars, is set in Indianapolis in the 1980s and was published by Penguin in March of this year. And he's currently working on a new collection of poems, Hearing Damage, as well as a graphic novel. So congratulations to Adrian Matika, new Indiana State Poet Laureate.
On display now through the end of the month at the Ashland Gallery in Broad Ripple is a wonderful collaboration between Johnny McKee and Kip Norman. Johnny does these very soothing, abstract kind of paintings, and Kip finds things and puts them together and creates art. And together the two have created a show that's worth the see at the Ashland Gallery in Broad Ripple through the end of December.
One of the great things about winter weather is it kind of forces us to think about things we can do inside where it's cozy and warm. And another great thing about this time of year is you may have some extra time to explore venues in your own hometown. And I have a new one to put on your list. The Library Center for Black Literature and Culture opened a couple months ago, October 21st, to standing room only crowds. It's housed in Central Library and it's dedicated to celebrating the vibrancy of Black heritage and history. And it boasts a special collection featuring works by and about Black figures. So check that out. Maybe take your kids along. Center for Black Literature and Culture at Central Library.
And two of our former Small Studio Session performers, Tad Robinson and Brett Wiskons, are both going to be performing different venues on Saturday, December the 23rd. Tad's going to be at Kona Jack's, and Brett will be out in Zionsville at the Cobblestone Grill.
If you're at Loose Ends this Saturday night, that's the 16th, and you are fascinated by stop-motion animation, which is enjoying a renaissance, actually, you might want to go down to the Garfield Park Arts Center's Vintage Movie Night. It's this Saturday night, the 16th, at 7 o'clock. Film historian Eric Grayson, he knows everything about film, he is screening milestones in early stop-motion animation using examples from 1912 to 1930, and he'll be available for questions afterward. You can find out more at gpacarts.org, gpacarts.org, or just show up at 7 o'clock.
And once again, through the end of December at the Indiana State Museum, it's the Peewinkles Puppet Studio. They have a variety of shows on different days, so when the kids get out of school and you need a place to go, take them down to Peewinkles Puppet Studio at the Indiana State Museum.
Over at Circle City Industrial Complex, Tom Potter, Gail Moore, and Nancy Frass are black and white photographers, and they're working on a January 1st Friday show called A Collector Show. They're actually doing a sneak peek on Thursday, January 4th, and then the first Friday opening on January 5th.
If those aren't enough reasons to get out and about in the city, there are some more at the IndieArts.org guide. That's IndieArts.org/guide. It's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Arts Guide for you. And we'll be back again next week with another look at the calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, coming up an innovative series at Indy's Second Presbyterian Church. But right now, our December small studio session performance is from an Indianapolis band that was one of the pioneers of the Fountain Square music scene, believe it or not, over a decade ago. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer introduces us to the members of Provada as they share music from their latest record.
I am Jesse Lee.
I'm Casey Tennis.
And I'm Hubert Glover.
And together, they are Provada. The band has been producing and performing original music together since 2004.
We start with the backbone, we write around it, we take it apart, we pick it apart, we rehearse it. Then we go into the studio and reorchestrate.
Jessica lies here by the side of the road, making new friends, alienating.
We want to get it to a place where we can perform it well, and then we want to add a little something extra that makes us fall in love with it a little more.
Some of those subtle changes can be heard on the tracks that make up their new record. It's titled Fill the Sea and will be released in the spring of 2018.
Well, the last one was a real rocker, you know. This one's more fleshed out. I believe it's a lot more mature. You know, with the arrangements, the orchestrations, even the lyrics, the whole approach is... Not that it doesn't rock. It rocks. But it'll also make you cry.
Yeah.
Each Provada record we have has a secret weapon musician mm-hmm. on it, so it creates a lot of timbres and texture, like Hubert said. You know, mm-hmm. it's much more fully realized, less straight ahead, us trying to be almost like snide glam.
Yeah, it's overproduced, as the other one was overproduced. You can hear more of us as playing in a room. That's kind of what we were going for.
The band plans to showcase a few of their songs from the new record as music videos and distribute a series of instrumental solo sessions, too. For WFYI News, I'm Jill Dittmeyer.
The secrets of a lesson hold, the feelings gone. Along the only road you know, the secret's gone. Is said. stole, a kiss that I stole, the exit of another girl, the feeling's gone, hysteria in America. Everywhere you go, chasing down your own fire.
You can see Pravada's small studio session and hear Jill's entire conversation with the band on our website at wfyi.org/small studio. Small Studio is made possible with support from Sun King Brewery and Nido Art Shop. For 2 months, a group of more than a dozen artists gathered to read and interpret the parable of the prodigal son at Indianapolis's Second Presbyterian Church. WFYI's Lauren Chapman spoke with two of the artists, Laura Storrs and David Barry, about their works and their own expressions of faith.
Both Laura Storrs and David Barry are poets, and that's about where their similarities end. Barry is an associate pastor at Second Presbyterian Church on the north side of Indianapolis. Storrs was raised in a religious household, but has left the church entirely.
I've been struggling for a while to try and find an outlet. I'm not a Christian, but I'm still pretty Christian compared to most people, and where do I fit? And this seemed like a place maybe where I could kind of fit, and so I thought I'd give it a try.
Both she and Barry participated in a program from Second Presbyterian called Faith Expressions, creating art from the parable of the prodigal son. Barry's poem is called Brother Knows.
As I stand, wraps it around me, showing all, I'm his beloved fellow. With my red stilettos on and yellow boa, we dance as one.
I tried to write about from the perspective of the older brother, and also from the perspective of the younger brother, and the struggles of identity that the younger brother is having and trying to live up to who the older brother was. Part the journey is the younger brother coming to terms with who he really is, and whether or not if he showed who he really was, would he be accepted by the family and by his father?
If that sounds like a coming out story, that's because it is. Barry's son is gay.
My own son had difficulties coming out to me, not because he felt that he would be rejected, but he felt that it might jeopardize my standing and my position in the church. And so he actually came out to a friend of mine who he knew was gay before he was able to come out to me.
He says it was hard to write something like this because he knew it could make people uncomfortable, but he wanted to share his perspective as a father and not as a pastor.
For me, that image of the father waiting for the son and offering unconditional love, and I thought of so many sons and daughters who may experience rejection in their family when they reveal who they truly are, that this passage in Scripture really talks about how God's love stretches beyond all the boundaries that we place upon people. And so that was important for me to really stretch what is meant by unconditional love.
Laura Storrs' poetry has a very different interpretation of the Scripture. That was the intention for the group and for Storrs.
I started this with purely selfish intentions, right? I'm mad and I want to just tell people about it. And that's what I did. And that's what these poems do, honestly. They're pretty mad. And I think that's okay. But I do, right? I came over the course of these weeks, over the course of seeing people respond positively to me reading this, you know, perhaps inflammatory poem.
She presented her poetry 2 weeks before the gallery in the seminar group that met for 2 months. Most of the people in that group attend Second Presbyterian. She shared a small portion of her poem, which ended, "If God loses his son, he stays home, reads the paper, flips through the channels, surfs the web, cleans the microwave, and finally brings a famine on Syria."
I finished reading my poem, and it was just dead silent in the room, and right then the nerves were still there, and I just felt like this vacuum in my stomach, like, oh, how are we going to move forward from this moment right here? And finally a lady spoke, and she said, "Don't be offended. I know we clapped for everyone else, but I just can't clap because I'm just stunned into silence. I don't know what to say or what to do." And I was kind of like, yeah, that seems fair. That was the intent of the poem. So I got what I wanted, I suppose.
WFYI's Lauren Chapman reporting on the Second Presbyterian's Faith Expressions Project, a project the church plans to do again next fall. The current exhibits are on display through the first few weeks of January, and you can learn more at secondchurch.org, secondchurch.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. As we approach the end of 2017, I want to look back on five incredible Indianapolis music legends that passed away this year. Bassist Mingo Jones passed away in April at the age of 88. Mingo was a legendary figure in the Indianapolis jazz scene, best known for his work with Wes Montgomery during the 1950s. We're going to listen to an excerpt of a live recording featuring Mingo with Wes Montgomery. This is from Resonance Records' Wes Montgomery anthology titled Echoes of Indiana Avenue. Vocalist and keyboard player Chucky Bush came to prominence in the late 1970s as a member of the Indianapolis soul supergroup Manchild. Bush recorded two fantastic LPs with Manchild and composed songs that stood toe-to-toe with the work of fellow Manchild bandmate and future superstar Kenny Babyface Edmonds. We're going to hear a sample of the Chucky Bush composition, Especially for You, from Manchild's 1977 debut album. Chucky Bush passed away in February at the age of 58. Tommy Willis was known around the Midwest as the man with a horn. Most Hoosiers likely associate Tommy Willis with big band music. The Tommy Willis Big Band kept up an active performance schedule from the 1980s well into the 2000s. But we're going to listen to a track from earlier in Willis' career when the saxophonist was active in the R&B music scene. We're going to listen to KC Drive, released on Willis' Indianapolis-based label Juke in 1973. Willis passed away in October at the age of 93. One of my all-time favorite Indianapolis bands is Amnesty, an incredible funk group that dominated the Indianapolis music scene during the early 1970s. Amnesty's bass player, James Red Massey, passed away in November at the age of 65. Let's listen to a track from the Amnesty anthology, Free Your Mind. We'll be right back. last artist we'll be focusing on today is the amazing vocalist and keyboard player Sarah McLaughlin, who passed away in September at the age of 91. Sarah was a graduate of Chris Bissadick's High School and also received music instruction at Indy's Jordan Conservatory. Sarah's career took off in Chicago during the late 1940s when she formed the pioneering all-women jazz quartet, the Cinquettes. And Sarah was also a pioneer on the Hammond organ, being among the first wave of jazz musicians to perform on the instrument. Let's listen to a sample of Sarah's work on the Hammond organ as we end this week's segment with her 1953 recording, Red Light.
Here, Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Lauren Chapman, Jill Dittmeyer, Shannon Forsell, and Emily Matheny. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, join us for our traditional program featuring spoken word and music celebrating the winter holidays. It's The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.